Hello everyone and welcome to the Leadership Insights blog. Today we have a very special guest with us today. It's David Maester. And David, welcome.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Good. I wanted to read your very impressive bio. Unfortunately, we don't have time for the extent of the amazing experience you have, but I would like to at least read a little bit about it just to give our listeners a sense of who you are. Would that be okay?
That would be great.
Thank you. Well, David Maester is widely acknowledged as one of the world's leading authorities in management of professional service firms. For over 25 years, he has advised all kinds of firms covering all strategic and management issues and building a global practice. David gets to travel all over the world and talking to his clients and helping them build effective organizations. He is the author of 13 books and most recently, Strategy and the Fat Smoker. He is a native of Great Britain and holds degrees from University of Birmingham, the London School of Economics, and a doctorate from Harvard Business School, where he later taught for 6 years. So very, very rich experience. Thank you again for being with us.
Not at all.
So David, would you like to tell us a little bit about your latest book and what inspired it?
Well, what inspired it is that having been a consultant for many years, I've been privileged to see many firms' strategic plans. And what I discovered is that they tend to be very, very similar and very, very sensible. In other words, most companies, you know, figure out the right conclusions that the keys to success are some very familiar things like, you know, provide outstanding customer service and get your people to act like team players and provide a great place to work. And these are familiar conclusions that most people put in their strategic plans. But they increasingly came to me to seem like the New Year's resolutions that all of us make at the beginning of every year. That we know we should eat less and exercise more, but just knowing what is good for us is not necessarily a good predictor that we're going to do it. In fact, we can fervently want the benefits, we can know what to do, and we can even know how to do it, but still that doesn't mean it will happen. And my final sort of summary is I came to realize that competition in almost any industry that I observe is not necessarily about having better ideas than other competitors do. It's about a superior ability to energize the organization to actually do it.
Well, I'm so glad to hear you say that because that's really what we're really interested in. And what do you think are some of the top ways for leaders to energize their teams to actually follow through on those strategic plans and not make them just like New Year's resolutions, which are never kept?
Well, I mean, there are, you know, we as human beings are all different, so the first thing you must say is different people are energized by different things. But, you know, let me quickly mention some of the things that might turn some people on. Some people say, well, let me inspire my troops with the clarity and power of my vision. But the honest truth is that, you know, unless you're a really charismatic person, you know, not many people successfully pull that off week in, week out, month in, month out, and year after year. You know, some people try and get their people to do it for the sake of the company, the greater glory of the company, and that doesn't really inspire people. Some people, unfortunately, do it, you know, work hard so that the shareholders can get rich, which may be a valid goal, but it's just not the most persuasive argument. You know, sometimes you get them to do it for you. In other words, you know, as somebody who had hired someone, people will do it out of gratitude of, I'm doing it for the boss. I don't necessarily believe in the vision or the strategy, but I'll do it for my manager. Just quickly, there are other possible arrows that would be in the quiver of a leader. You could have somebody who's not yet responsive to the things we said, but might respond to a sense of teamwork, that I'm in this together with my colleagues, and I will do my part and stay late and come in on Sunday to do it for the glory of the team. It could even go on to be another one, which is that I'm not necessarily responsive to teamwork, but I'll do it out of a sense of responsibility. In other words, there are even more junior people than me who depend upon me, and I'm going to do my best work and put in the extra level of energy so that my subordinates will have, you know, opportunities. That's a possibility you could use. Two more that I might mention as possibilities. One is there are people who are not receptive to any of the appeals I've given so far, And there are at least two more you could use. One is, you know, if you're not doing it for the client, excuse me, if you're not doing it for the company, then do it for the customer or the client. In other words, try and create a feeling amongst the employees that we're there to serve the customer or client, and that's why it's deserving of their attention. A final one is you might have people who are not responsive to any of those, and to them, you try and appeal to their pride. It's a sort of bet-you-can't-do-this sort of appeal. And notice there's a wide variety there, and I think the most important lesson that a leader has to say is if you're only trying to use one appeal, it's probably going to reach only a fraction of your people. Part of the art of leadership is recognizing what turns other people on and learning how, as a manager or leader, to evoke those motivations in other people. My observation is too many leaders figure out what motivates them and hope that the thing that motivates them will motivate everybody else. And that's just false.
Oh, what a great point. So how would a leader go about, especially if they're particularly a new leader or maybe they're in charge of a new company or a new team, how would they go about figuring out what turns on these different people and how do they keep that all in balance if there's all these different motivation styles?
Well, one of the tricks of management, I hate to use that word, but I will, is the following slogan, which is that people do things for themselves. There's very few, you know, people out there who will do things, as I've said, for the company or the glory or the vision. So part of the art, the trick of management, is getting people to do things for themselves that turn out to be very beneficial for the company. So it's a matter of having one-on-one discussions with each person, talking about where they want to go, where their next challenge is, you know, what they would find exciting and enthusiastic for their next stage of their career, and then as the manager and leader, trying to find a way in the organization to say, how do I find an overlap to accommodate the thing the person is enthusiastic about anyway, and find to put that to good use to advance the cause of the company. And notice what that requires is starting with the passions of individuals, and then working from the bottom up rather than from the top down. The virtue of working from the bottom up is if you started with what people want to do for themselves anyway, the likelihood that they will actually passionately go away and do it is much greater.
Mm. So definitely appeal to people's own their own motivation as opposed to try to enforce something on them from the company that may not even speak to them at all.
Well, again, I don't think this is a, you know, in any way a moral point or a religious point or a political point. Mm-hmm. I think this is just you and me and most other human beings in the world, which is none of us like to think of ourselves as wage slaves, and yet we sometimes find ourselves in that situation. And imagine you or I or anybody else being in an organization, and we don't really want to do it, and we don't really feel turned on by it, but we're given objectives and goals by our boss that don't particularly relate to us as individuals. Now, we may still...
We don't have to use our imagination very hard, do we? Because for most of us, we've experienced that, and for many of us, that's why we do leadership development work, so we don't, you know, we don't have to see other people suffer through that.
Yeah, you know, that's exactly the point, which is, but, you know, I think that what I've learned is that we sometimes forget about what it felt like when we were in that position. Mm-hmm. I've noticed a very strange, you know, thing that happens to all of us, is that when we're talking about them, we come up with different answers than when we're talking about us. So if you are saying, well, what motivates us, and what do we respond to, it's very interesting that we often come up with a different list than when we're talking about them, the employees. And again, the second little trick here, or the second insight that I would bring to bear, is that it's not a bad first hypothesis, the first theory, to say if you really want to know what would turn on the people who work for you, why not at least start with the theory that even though we're not all alike, you know, the set of things that we're likely to get through to you is probably not a bad first, you know, guessing place as to figure out what are likely to work with your employees.
Mm. David, when you and I first met, we were at a seminar that I was listening to that you were presenting at, And you had told a really fantastic story about an interaction you had with your wife that really demonstrated to me what you're talking about when you speak about having this very coach-like qualities of a leader. Can you share that story?
Yes, very briefly, I'll set it up by, you know, giving you the punchline first and then the story. You know, the punchline is that, you know, what a really good manager, leader, or coach, and notice those words, you know, kind of overlap with each other, is focusing on how should I handle this so that I actually get the result I want, rather than trying to come across as the boss. So very briefly, here's the story. My wife came into my study at home one evening and said, "Darling, I've got a very big problem. I need your help." So I, of course, said, "Yes, what can I help with?" And she said, "Well, as you know, we're having a dinner party for friends tonight, and I was going over the list, my love," she says, "and it looked like there was a lot of things that needed to get done. Shop for the ingredients, cook the meal, clean the house, set the table, choose the music, buy the flowers." And she says that as I was listing everything that needed to get done, it looked as if there might not be quite enough time for it all to happen perfectly, and I do so much want this evening to go well. "So," she says, "my darling, I wonder if you have any advice for me." Now, the point of saying it that way is to point out immediately that the facts were on her side and the morality was on her side. If she had wanted to, it would have been quite valid to do a performance appraisal, yeah, which is what most of us in business would have had the instincts of, coming to somebody who's not actually living up and making the contribution they should be making, and criticizing them, tell them where they are weak in their performance, and issuing instructions about how they need to get better. Now, notice that would have been valid and appropriate, but if you imagine the situation I was in, I hope we can all agree that the likelihood I would respond to a performance appraisal is in fact much less than the way my wife did it, which is, you know, here's a situation, I've got a problem, you know, what advice do you have for me? And one of the things that my wife understands intuitively is that if you really want to get somebody to respond to you, then we know a few things about human beings, and that is we don't respond well to being criticized, even if the criticism is valid. As human beings, we have a sort of defense mechanism. And this is something which is, as a boss or as a, you know, superior or as a manager, it's very hard to learn. Because you know you're right, you know your criticism is valid, you have every right in the world to come in and do this performance appraisal, but what you have to learn over the years is doing it that way is not actually in your self-interest. What you really have to say is, I'm dealing with a human being here, what's the best way to have this conversation so they are most likely to absorb the implied criticism, but notice it's implied, and actually act in the way I want them to. And part of it, in that old language, is helping the other person save face, which is a very important principle.
Well, it sounds like your wife is just a brilliant diplomat naturally, isn't she?
Because I think some people are, or maybe, you know, having grown up in a large family, where she had to compete to get the attention, or the right, share of the food, maybe she just learned how to do it at a young age. I think there are some naturals, and notice I would rush to say there are some people who will never be any good at it, because my opinion is that in order to be good at getting other people to respond to you, you must be willing to go through that circuitous thought process that says, how do they think about this? What's the best way I can say it to get them to respond? And it means thinking of the other person with some degree of understanding and empathy. And I have to report to you that there are some people who just don't have the patience for that. They say,
I've had some of those people as my bosses, for sure.
Well, exactly. And so, I think there are some people who will never learn because they fail the attitude test of management, which is that do you have the patience to get the results you want? But I do think that most of us are in the middle, that there are some management and influence skills we could develop if we were prepared to learn them.
So, David, imagine somebody is coming from a culture that is a little, how should I say it delicately, dictatorial, you know, and right. That is kind of expected of managers and leaders, and I'm sure you've seen that in your work, right?
Right.
And they're coming into an organization where, you know, perhaps some people are demoralized and they have to use a much more velvet glove approach in getting results out of their people.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's supposed that there are those people who are kind of in the middle. You know, they're kind of used to telling people what to do and how to do it, but they understand that that may not be the best approach. How does somebody like that go about cultivating the skills that they need to get the best out of those people?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is I think there's two sides to this that I draw your attention to generalize it. There's a book that was written by the CEO of Hewitt Associates, and I wrote the foreword for this book. It was called The 2R Manager, and the two letters R stood for requiring and relating. And the point was, you can't be a good manager unless you know how to be requiring of people. You know, you've got to put challenges in front and say, come on, you can do it. You know, you can't be the type of person who lets people underperform. But on the other hand, you also have to be good at relating to people. You know, do it in a way that convinces them that you're actually dealing with them as human to human. Now, if you notice, that's what my wife was doing. Right? Mm-hmm. It was a velvet glove, but there was an iron fist inside there too. Right? There was, it was very clear that she may have used different language skills, but she was basically coming in saying, you know, we need to discuss this situation. And I think the thing I would draw to people's attention is that the recipients respond very, very well if you come in a, you know, at a situation where previously they've had nothing but demand. And somebody comes in and says, look, we need to improve this situation. You know, things aren't going as well as they could. This is a closed-door meeting. Let's talk about, you know, what could be done to improve it. And I'll give my own experience trying to learn how to do this. When I left the university, I had a lady who came with me to be my business manager, and I made the same mistake that everybody makes, which is, since I didn't like personal interactions that much, instead of giving personal feedback during the year, I tried to adopt a performance appraisal system whereby, you know, I saved up all of my performance feedback for an entire year so I could give it to her all at once on 9 different subjects, 6 or 7 months after it had happened, right at the time when it affected her pay. Now, that's, of course, the way most performance appraisal systems work. And when you state it that way, I hope it's clear that it might result in getting the right amount of pay to the right people, but it's a very ineffective system for actually raising performance. What I've learned is that if I could learn when something was only good and could have been excellent, if I went into my assistant and said, look, one topic at a time, right when it happened, it's got nothing to do with pay, but here is something that I think could be improved, could we talk about it? The likelihood that person would respond was actually quite high, because I was talking about a substantive performance issue, but I was talking to them with a degree of respect. And what I'm trying to stress is that it's not an either-or. People will, in fact, raise their substantive performance and contribute to the success of the organization if you go in and make them part of the solution process rather than in a performance evaluation mode.
So you're, again, iterating the importance of being collaborative with people as opposed to sitting, you know, across from them and saying, you know, this is how you can do this and it's coming from you, rather than you're saying elicit it from them.
Well, let me be clear. I don't want to be Pollyanna here. I think
that's
the approach you try, you know, 3 times. I mean, I must rush to state the other side, which is I'm a great believer in the additional principle that, you know, a company, any organization, can only achieve its goals if the people are engaged and excited and enthused. Now, what I'm trying to report is responsibility number one lies with the manager, which is, do you actually have the talent to engage and infuse and excite people? And notice
right.
I'm saying...
You're pretty self-aware, huh?
Right, I'm saying that's mostly the manager's possibility. And in fact, if you're finding that 90% of your staff is not engaged, the solution is not to fire 90% of the managers. Excuse me, 90% of the staff. The solution is maybe I need to learn how to engage people. But I am trying to say that I operate on the principle of sort of three strikes and you're out sort of thing. In other words, you know, there are people I will never get through to. You know, and I have, in spite of trying to treat them with respect and putting challenges in front of them, it turns out they are just looking for a job, not a career. They are looking for a 9-to-5. And my own philosophy is, look, I will do my best, but if I cannot find a way to get you engaged, then you and I need to have a very serious talk about, is this a place where you want to continue working? Because this is not a place where we carry passengers. Mm-hmm. Now, I believe that needs to be there as well.
Well, yeah, you're asking people to be very aware and very balanced in their approach. And assuming that most of our listeners are going to be in the category of leaders who actually want to learn how to do it better, what are some of the best resources that you can point them to continue their learning?
Well, I mean, obviously, apart from my own books, I think probably the place I would start is the book I referred to, which is The 2R Manager by Peter Friedes, F-R-I-E-D-E-S. I would go right the way back to Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. And I'm also a fan, by the way, of The 1 Minute Manager. You know, it's not necessarily the most academically respectable book, but I do think that what it contains is, in fact, very sensible and effective advice.
Mm. And if I may make a plug for your website, David, your website has the most amazing information on it. Whenever I go through it, I learn so much, and I just think that your podcasts and all kinds of articles that you have written just illustrate your points fantastically. And can I say that I just told somebody that I know that I'm interviewing you, and he said, I am reading Strategy and a Sad Smoker, and it's one of the best books on the topic I've ever read.
Oh, well, you've made my day. Thank you very much for those compliments.
You're so welcome. Well, you've made our day, and thank you so much for being with us today, David.
Well, not at all, and good luck to everybody.
Thank you.